Hi, I'm Molly Wonsall.
And I'm Geoffrey Wonsall.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we've been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
Which is what prompted us to start this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wonsall and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wonsall.
Hello everyone, welcome back. Thank you for listening, as I always say, and I mean every word of it. It's a delight to know that so many people are interested in what Molly and I do, and we're utterly thrilled.
I mean, it's actually just a sideline for me.
Well, it's a sort of a sideline for me, I suppose, but no, it isn't really.
I don't think true crime is a sideline for you.
No, I do rather a lot of it now, almost by accident. But it is hugely encouraging to hear so many people actually responding to what we do. So we'd love to hear from you, as we always say.
Oh, yeah, please do email us, tweet us.
Yes.
Instagram us.
Please.
I put a video on our Instagram, Dad of All Your Books.
Oh.
For our first ep of Ed Kemper, because we talked a lot about all your books.
Uh-huh.
We showed everyone just how many books you have to get through to review.
I do have a lot. I do. That's true.
But yes, we have all those things, bloodties.podcast@gmail.com and bloodties_pod for Twitter and Instagram.
But if you Google Blood Ties, you get to those, do you?
Yeah. Or you can go to Geoffrey's...
You go to my website.
Website.
We might make a website for the podcast.
I mean, you know, we've got great ambitions, haven't we, Dan?
We have.
We've got big ambitions, people. So if you can do as we've asked before and just tell one friend who doesn't listen to listen and see if they could just tell one friend.
Yep.
We'd be really thrilled.
We'd be absolutely delighted.
Anything we can do to get the listeners up.
Yep.
Would be super.
Yes.
That's our
aim.
That's our big aim.
But we began, and I think it's right, in a small way, so that we learnt the ropes as we went along, so to speak.
I hope that people find the way that we present true crime appealing. I was just thinking about that. There are a few people, obviously I take all reviews, I take all on board. Some people find it kind of a bit too twee, I think.
Yes.
Which is fair enough. They prefer things to be more perfunctory when it comes to the presentation of this.
Especially when it's dark material.
Yeah, this kind of information. So, but I think also the way we present it probably makes it, strangely, more palatable in some ways.
I do too.
Which is good for some people and not for others.
But you can never please. So one thing I have learnt, doing this, is you simply cannot please all the people all of the time.
No.
You're always going to do something wrong. I'm perfectly relaxed about that because I know in my heart that I'm trying to do the right thing. I'm trying to do the honourable. I'm trying to describe these dishonourable people in an honourable way.
Yeah, well, you do that very well.
So I'm very pleased about that. One book this week I just mentioned before we start is a wonderful thing. I was sent it. It's called 32nd Forensic Science. We've mentioned it on the podcast before.
We did a long time ago. But as we approach Christmas, and it's always good to be ahead of the game, this is the sort of book we think would make a good Christmas present for a true crime fan.
Yep. It's published by the Ivy Press. I'm not going to try and pronounce the names of the authors because they're completely beyond me, but they're consultant editors and both are directors of the Leverhulme Research Centre for Forensic Science at the University of Dundee in Scotland.
And what's it got? Sort of, is it sort of factual?
It's basically a background on all the things you might want to know. So forensic archaeology, drug use, ballistics, dyes and pigments,
so all the
body
things
fluids,
that they would use to find, to discover crimes.
Fibers, glass,
so interesting.
Iris recognition, facial image comparison.
All the things that
all
can
the
be
things,
used forensically to
DNI
identify
profiling,
murderers.
What the biometrics glossary is, what does it mean? It's an absolute gold mine.
And it's very palatable. It's got not palette. What's the word when something's
accessible?
Easy, accessible.
Yeah.
And could be a good prezi or just something for yourself if you're
interested. If you enjoy it. I mean, it has, for example, a little entry on admissibility of evidence. For evidence to be relevant to a court case, a judge will decide whether it would assist the jury in their deliberations regarding support for or against the charges brought by the prosecution. So, for example, you can have, as you know, evidence not admitted by the judge because he regards it as prejudicial to the case.
I do know that.
But we're about to deal with a case today in which there wasn't any
evidence. Well, yeah, this week we're doing Lord Lucan. We don't need to give him and he's just Lord Lucan.
Absolutely. He's and if you Google Lord Lucan, you get the Lord Lucan. There are other Lord Lucans, but you do indeed. And it is one of the most remarkable cases of the 20th century.
Okay, well, here we go then, Lord Lucan.
Richard John Bingham, who was to become the 7th Earl of Lucan, was born on the 18th of December 1934. He was the eldest son of George Bingham, the 6th Earl of Lucan. He had an elder sister. The Lucan family were actually very distinguished. The 3rd Earl of Lucan was in charge of the cavalry at the Battle of Balaclava, the Light Brigade and the Heavy Brigade.
Charge of the Light Brigade?
Yes. Lucan and Cardigan, who led the charge, loathed each other. And Lucan was in charge of both bits of the cavalry. His son, his great-great-grandson, John, always known as John Bingham, was born in Marylebone. But then, as war broke out, he was evacuated first to Wales and then to Canada, where he lived with a very rich friend of the family, and didn't in fact return until after the war had ended. I mean, as a lot of the aristocrats did, they left, whether it was for the West Indies or Canada or America, or indeed Africa. So you could say he had a gilded childhood. He returned to this country and was sent to Eton, as of course his father had been to Eton. One thing he did learn there was an appetite for gambling, not unfamiliar among Etonians, I'm told. But then in 1953, he signed up for his national service in his father's regiment, the Coldstream Guards, and he became a second lieutenant.
What does that mean?
The most junior officer.
I don't understand army things.
Okay, it was the most junior officer.
Okay.
Second lieutenant, lieutenant, major, lieutenant colonel, colonel, brigadier, major general, lieutenant general, general.
Gosh.
I won't do the non-commission.
That's impressive. How do you know all of that?
Well, just one of the things I stacked away in my memory.
You were never in the army.
No, but that's, I lived in officers' quarters at one point with my parents. He was an excellent backgammon player and a very fine bridge player.
I love backgammon.
I can't play it.
Oh, well, I can teach you.
I'd like to know, but I've, you know.
It's an excellent game for two.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't play it for gambling, though.
No. As he grew into an adult, he was a very, you know, handsome, tall, athletic, had a guardsman's moustache. They don't have guardsman's moustaches as much these days as they used to.
What does it mean?
Well, it's a black, big black, yeah, bushy moustache. Hair sleeked back. He was a larger-than-life figure, devil-may-care, playboy. It's said by some, I'm not sure if I believe it, that he was the prototype for Ian Fleming's James Bond. Certainly when they came to make the first film, Lucan was considered for a part. Not to play Bond.
He's not an actor.
No, he was never an actor. Never. He was a gambler. An early member of John Aspinall's Claremont Club in Berkeley Square, above Annabelle's, as it then was.
I don't think anyone will know what that is.
Ah, well, the Claremont Club was one of the first major casinos in London, run by a man who'd run gambling in all sorts of ways.
It was for posh people.
It was pretty much for posh people. At this point, John Bingham, still then called Lord Bingham, not Lord Lucan, because mm-hmm. his father was still alive, mm-hmm. was working for a merchant bank. But on one particular day, gambling, on Chemin de Fer, it's a... You can look it up.
Did you say? On
Chemin de Fer. It's literally the French word for railway.
Chemin de Fer.
Yes. The Iron Road. It's basically a game of chance with cards.
Oh, it's a game.
Yes. It's a gambling game. It's not all that far from Pontoon, but it's slightly more complicated.
Chemin
de Fer. Yes. Anyway, he won in 1960 £20,000, which was a very considerable amount of money.
Oh, I'm spelling it totally wrong.
He decided that a man who could win £20,000 in a single night didn't need to be a banker, and left to become effectively a full-time gambler.
Sorry, I'm distracted by reading about it. We'll put a link. We'll put some info about it somewhere.
Okay. His day was focused around. He would get up late. He would.
Do you know any professional gamblers?
I've met a couple. Yeah. Yes. They're usually real professionals. I mean, the thing about Lucan was that he was in and out all the time. The real professionals, they concentrate like heck. Mm. You know, they can count the cards, they can know the horses, whatever it is.
Those professional poker players.
No, absolutely. It's a life. Mm. It's a life's work.
But he obviously had, outside of quitting work, he had his own, he had private money.
He had some private money. He wasn't hugely wealthy, but never mind. He wasn't, you know. Early in 1963, not long after he'd left the merchant bank, he met a girl called Veronica Duncan at a party, who was to become his wife. She was a model. She was really quite beautiful when she was small, much smaller than he was. Her sister had married William Shand Kidd, half-brother to Peter Shand Kidd, who was stepfather to Diana Spencer, later Princess of Wales. Well-connected. They married on the 20th of November 1963 at the Brompton, Trinity Brompton. 2 months later, at the end of January 1964, John Bingham's father, the 6th Earl of Lucan, died, and he inherited the title. He also inherited £250,000.
Handy. How much would that have been back then? More, a lot more.
£4 million? Slightly more. He wasn't a flamboyant man. If I've given the impression that he was a playboy, that's true. But he loved driving Aston Martins and speedboats and all that sort of thing. But in himself, he was quite shy and introverted. So he had this sort of rather flamboyant exterior and this rather introverted interior. Mm. And which you talk to people who knew him, and I know a couple of people who did know him. They always said, it wasn't the way he was. That, you know, that all that flashiness, when you actually got John on his own, that wasn't the man he really was. But there you go. That's the contradiction in the whole Lucan story. Veronica bore John, now Lucan, 3 children. Only people who didn't know him called him Lucky Lucan. It became one of his nicknames in the wake of the 20,000 at Chemin de Fer. Mm-hmm. Anybody who knew Lucan only ever called him John. Veronica turned out to be a slightly frail individual. She got severe postnatal depression. She had the third child in 1970. And
that doesn't mean she's frail.
No, that's a fair point, but she was frail. as I think I can prove later on in the story.
But I just don't want us to link fragility and mental health issues.
No, that's a very, very good point.
Okay.
They tried to help her with some kind of psychotherapy, but I don't think she was very willing, and she thought she could handle it. It was a difficult issue. And when the, they bought a house in Lower Belgrave Street, in just south of Eaton Square, number 46. And they had a pretty strained Christmas there in 1972, which effectively saw the marriage collapse. Lucan moved out, leaving Veronica at home with the children. They had a string of nannies to help her look after them. Lucan moved nearby, first to Eaton Row and then to Elizabeth Street. They're literally, round the corner, effectively, from this bit of Lower Belgravia. But then began what was the inciting incident, if you like, a custody battle. Lucan believed that his wife Veronica wasn't capable of looking after his three children. He entered into a very, very prolonged, unpleasant battle to take the children away from Veronica. He did all manner of incredibly ridiculous things. He would stay outside the house in his car. He would, when she was making a phone call and he was in the house, he would record the phone call. All sorts of absurd, really, behaviour. But evidence that something in his mind had gone slightly wrong. At the same time, of course, he was beginning to lose. He was spending money fast. He accused her of spending money like water. The reality was he was spending money like water. He was gambling and he was losing. And he was losing relentlessly. He was starting to begin to borrow money from his friends. 10,000 here, 3,000 there, 5,000 there. He asked one dear friend for a loan, a guaranteed loan of 100,000. I mean, he had spent a lot of money. He was drinking heavily. He was chain smoking. And he was haunting the Claremont Club, where he gambled.
Yeah. And it was that really awkward thing when someone's gone off the boil and it's all desperation and they owe money everywhere.
Absolutely. Yeah. His life was falling apart. And at one point...
Gambling is a severe addiction.
It is. At one point, he confessed to a friend that all his troubles would be over if he killed his wife.
And why did he think that?
Well, I don't think his financial troubles would have been over, but he would have got the custody of the children.
But he needed money more than...
He did need money, but he hoped, I think he believed, because his mother was still alive, that, there was more money in the family somewhere. It was a bad summer in 1974. He struggled and the custody had gone against him. The judge decided that he could see the children every other weekend. You know, she was perfectly capable of looking after them. She wasn't psychologically disturbed. She was fine. I think she was, as we were discussing earlier, slightly frail, but she wasn't psychologically disturbed. Now, you can only speculate what was in John Lucan's mind. But one or two things are pretty clear. On the 7th of November, 1974, on the evening of the 7th of November, 1974, Lady Lucan was at home with the current nanny, whose name was Sandra Rivett. She had been born Hensby She had been married to a man called Roger Rivett, but now marriage had broken down and she'd enrolled with a Belgravia domestic agency and had got a job as a nanny to Lady Lucan and her three children. Now, it's important to remember, and indeed it was part of the story, that Sandra Rivett almost always took Thursday night off to meet her current boyfriend.
This sounds like something out of a Poirot.
It is a bit.
Cook always had Thursday nights off.
The cook was never there on a Thursday, yes. And that was the opportunity. Sandra, on this particular Thursday, had seen her boyfriend the night before and so had decided to stay in the house with Lady Lucan and the children. And at about 5 to 9 in the evening, she asked Veronica Lucan if she'd like a cup of tea. And Veronica Lucan said, that'll be wonderful. Thank you so much. And first floor drawing room, the kitchen's in the basement. Okay, some classic formation of a London house.
Yep.
First floor drawing room. So Sandra Rivett goes downstairs and then down into the basement, where the light bulb has been removed. She went to switch on the light. It's dark. And out of nowhere, someone, a man, begins to hit her over the head with a lead pipe bound in bandages, and at the same time proceeds to punch her in the face. He kills her, and, make matters worse, stuffs her body into a cotton mail sack, canvas mail sack.
His Mrs. Lucan can't hear any of this going
no.
on.
No, she's two floors up.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, a little time passes and Lady Lucan wonders what's happened and goes down to the top of the basement stairs and calls down, Sandra? No reply. When all of a sudden, up the stairs comes a man that Lady Lucan recognises as her husband, John.
This is really creepy.
Yes. She recognised him. And then, I think fearing for her life, in fact, I'm certain fearing for her life, she persuades him to come back upstairs and to talk about what's happened. She clearly thinks that he's killed, or at least very badly wounded, Sandra Rivett. But he calms down and, I mean, she embraces him. He's got blood on him. She gets blood on her. So, and she persuades him to take a tranquilizer and go into the bathroom. When he goes into the bathroom, she runs out of the house, turns left to the pub on the corner, which is called the Plumber's Arms. The most dramatic moment of the story. She runs in, shouting, "Help me, help me. I've just escaped from being murdered. He's murdered my nanny." And then collapsed.
And she's covered in blood.
Yes. Must have been a very dramatic scene, to put it politely. Lucan realises that she's gone. He goes outside, gets into the ancient car that he's borrowed for some reason or other, a Ford Corsair, a most unlikely car for Lucan, who usually had Jaguars or Aston Martins.
Well, that's probably why.
And leaves. He phones his mother and says, "There's been a terrible catastrophe. You must go to 46 Lower Belgrave Street at once and collect the children. I'll be in touch." She says, "You must go to the police." He said, "Oh, no, I'll be in touch later. I'll speak to them in the morning." Lady Lucan, naturally enough, does contact the police, and indeed the police break into 46 Lower Belgrave Street to discover the bloodied, beaten and dead body of Sandra Rivett, and at the same time discover that Lady Lucan has collapsed in the pub and she's gone to hospital. In the meantime, Lucan has driven to Uckfield in Sussex because he has a friend there, friends. Indeed, they became the last person to see John Lucan alive. He disappears into the night in the early hours of Friday, November the 8th. About the same time as Detective Chief Superintendent Roy Ranson, who became the senior investigating officer, turned up at Lower Belgrave Street. He quickly interviewed Lucan's mother and his wife, she in hospital, but still able to, you know, give a coherent explanation. And 2 days later, on the Sunday morning, the 10th of November, the disappeared Corsair is found parked in Newhaven in Sussex, where there is a ferry to France. A bandaged lead pipe, similar to the one, but not the same one, that was found as the murder weapon in Belgrave Street, is found in the boot, along with a bottle of vodka and some blood in the car. But there is no sign whatever of John Lucan. A warrant for Lucan's arrest is issued on the 12th, Tuesday, and Interpol are alerted. Many people thought that he got on a ferry, even though he didn't have his passport with him. His passport was still in his flat. There was a great deal of speculation that he just simply disappeared to France. No sign was ever found of whatever happened to Lord Lucan. There have been speculation galore about where he was, what happened, and we'll come to that in a minute. But as far and to all intents and purposes, he disappeared off the face of the earth after parking the Ford Corsair in Newhaven. It was extraordinary. Nice. Literally vanished. A year later, well, 6 months later, in June 1975, an inquest decided that Rivett, Sandra Rivett, had indeed been killed by Lucan. It was that he was the last person to be named as a murderer in the coroner's court, because the law changed 2 years later so that the inquest couldn't say, we think X did it. And he was the first member of the House of Lords to be named as a murderer since 1760, when the 4th Earl of Ferrers was hanged for killing his bailiff. It was a most remarkable event. But in spite of that, no sign of Lord Lucan, the 7th Earl. In fact, the family didn't... Probate wasn't granted until the late 90s. And his son, George, didn't finally inherit his father's title until after a death certificate had been issued. And he didn't actually take the title until 2016.
Probably didn't want it.
Well, it was quite a famous line, an Anglo-Irish line. Mm. You know, a big history.
Yeah.
You know. It's perhaps also important to say at this point, before we go into what might have happened, that Veronica Lucan, Lady Lucan, became estranged from her children. They wouldn't speak to her. And she became a very sad figure indeed.
Why wouldn't they speak to her?
Well, there was an awful lot of blame sloshing about who did what. Yeah. And she was, as I say, a little frail. So frail indeed that she wrote a book about her experiences and then not that long afterwards committed suicide.
That's sad.
Because she was convinced she had Parkinson's disease. In fact, she hadn't. But at that point, she died. But let's go back to what might have happened to John Lucan. John Aspinall, his old friend from the Clermont Club, believed that he jumped off a speedboat having tied a stone round his waist.
Oh yeah, he was sort of part of a gang of kind of cool rollers of that kind of Aspinall.
That's right.
Sort of like a set of posh lads, wasn't it?
That's right.
Yeah. They were all his buddies. And didn't they say they all kind of covered up for him?
That's right. That's a separate issue. And I remember asking Jimmy Goldsmith, who was one of those.
Was he in their gang?
Yeah, he was, yeah.
Dad wrote a book about James Goldsmith, who was in his gang.
But he wasn't there on that particular day when the meeting at the Clermont Club took place, which was a result of a piece later in Private Eye that resulted in the whole Golden Balls criminal libel trial.
We're going to have to look up separately, people.
It's a big diversion.
A whole separate thing.
But Veronica, his widow, the late Lady Lucan, who killed herself in 2017, always thought that he'd killed himself. Some thought that he jumped off the rear of the New Haven ferry so that he would be chopped up by the propellers. I've always thought that was a little...
Oh, that's horrible.
Well, I thought it was a little unlikely because you get body parts, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not
but it's odd not to find a body, I suppose, hence the weighing down with rocks.
Yes, but there were other. A DCS Roy Ranson, the senior investigative officer, believed that he'd escaped to South Africa, where he'd cut off his moustache and changed his hair. And
yeah, so why is it that I have an association in my head with Pol Pot? Is that just...
I don't know. I mean, there were all sorts of... I mean, one News of the World story insisted they'd found him in America. There was another one in Asia. It all turned out to be completely false. There is one quite interesting theory. One of his friends thought that his escape had been masterminded by an illegal gambling gang with which he was associated, who'd spirited him away to Switzerland, where it's easier to hide your identity, according to Swiss law. But in the end, he'd become, surplus to requirements, and they'd killed him and disposed of his body.
That sounds fanciful.
Well,
maybe.
One thing is true. His Lady Lucan never thought he could cope in a foreign country. He never thought he would be capable of living in wherever you choose, you know, Thailand, South Africa.
Well, my advice in life would be don't underestimate people.
No, well, it's very good advice.
But
it remains, the case of Lord Lucan remains one of the great unsolved mysteries.
That is so fascinating.
Just like Mr. Kipper at Jill Dando.
Yeah.
You know.
Bible John.
Yep. Bible John.
Lord Lucan.
And it still has a resonance today because we still don't know.
What happened to him?
What happened to him? We know what happened. I'm sure we know what happened in Lower Belgrave Street that night.
Yeah.
But what happened to him?
Who knows? God, that's fascinating. Thanks so much, Dad. I really enjoyed that.
Pleasure, darling.
And I'm obviously sad about that lady being killed, but it was more...
Well, she was in the wrong place at the wrong time. It was as simple as that. I mean, He thought the woman was coming down the stairs.
Was going to be his wife.
His wife.
And then he wasn't meant to be
And
there.
It wasn't. Yeah. And she thought... You know, I think it's circumstantial, but I think it's pretty clear.
Yeah.
But...
Definitely.
This... Sad. I never met him. I met a lot of the others. But his disappearance caused, a lot of pain. One of the people who attended the meeting at the Claremont in the wake of his disappearance, Dominic Elwes, took his own life. John Aspinall's mother suggested to the police that, I think she said, albeit with a hint of irony in her voice, that she was sure he'd been fed to my son's tigers.
Oh, yes, the Aspinalls have this sort of
posh zoo. Yeah.
Like one of them always sort of sits in cages with gorillas and stuff.
That's right. But it is a great story. They've attempted to dramatise it on a number of occasions.
Yeah, so,
you know.
I remember that. Yeah. I remember one anyway. Do you remember it when it was happening?
Oh, very much so. Yeah. Oh, very much so.
Must have been all over the press.
It was. I was at LBC then. And it was a very big deal indeed. It was a very busy news time as well because we had a lot of bombs as well.
Bombs in London?
Bombs in London, yeah.
Those were IRA bombs?
Yes, IRA bombs. We had a lot of those. I have had the good fortune or misfortune to be shot at and blown up. Not something I recommend.
No. Thankfully, you're still here to tell the tale.
Thankfully, those days are behind me.
HelloFresh is the UK's leading recipe box service, delivering fresh, pre-proportioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes to your door. It's the easy, convenient way to cook delicious dinners from scratch every time. Choose your favourites from 19 recipes a week, including rapid recipes, ready in 20 minutes or less, family favourites, British and world cuisine, and even a lower calorie balance range. And because all their fresh ingredients come from their suppliers, pre-portioned for you, there's no food waste. Hey Dad, I wanted to tell you about HelloFresh. It's this recipe box service that I've tried. They deliver food to your door, you choose the recipes you want, and then everything comes pre-portioned with a recipe card, and you make it yourself. I found it really brilliant because I work such long hours and they provide a special set of recipes which you can cook in under 20 minutes. So when I get home from work, I can make myself a delicious meal and still have an evening, which, as you know, isn't always easy.
I do know that, darling.
And the great news is that HelloFresh are offering our listeners £60 off 4 boxes. All you've got to do is visit HelloFresh.co.uk and enter the code BloodTies when you check out. So you should definitely give it a go.
Oh, I'm going to give it a go. It's got so many benefits. I mean, I gather it has a flexible subscription with no minimum term, so you can change your delivery day and skip weeks to suit yourself. I think it sounds like a terrific idea. You can choose a range of cuisines. As you say, there are recipes to cook in 20 minutes. But they also do family-friendly recipes, world cuisine, something to suit everyone.
Yeah, and did you know on average a household has 6 recipes that they stick to? HelloFresh can help you get out of that cooking rut by giving you 19 different recipes to choose from a week.
So, as you say, it's great news. HelloFresh are offering our listeners £60 off 4 boxes. Just go to hellofresh.co.uk and enter BloodTies when you check out to enjoy really delicious dinners without the drama. But what about this week, Mo? What's in store? Anything exciting? What about the return? Have you got great premieres to go to? And
Downton Abbey, the movie.
Oh, made by my friend Gareth Neame.
Yeah.
And starring my other friend Hugh Bonneville.
Yeah, or your buddies.
Yeah.
Miles is doing his show in London again. So good. He can come because he didn't come last time.
I didn't come. I'd like to see it.
Doing a week, I think, at Wyndham's. So that will be good. And what else? I've got someone doing Macbeth at Chichester.
Oh, good.
With John Sim.
Oh, my word.
And Dervla Kerwin.
My word. Crikey.
What else do I have? Tom Mothersdale is at the Royal Court in a trio of Carol Churchill plays. So, yeah, there's a few things.
Few things coming up.
Coming up.
Yeah, what am I doing?
September.
Yes, I think as we turn into September, we both get busier.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Well, thanks, Dad. That was really fascinating.
Thank you, darling. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
Yes, we should say thank you to everyone.
Yes, please.
And thank you to Poppy Damon, our producer. Thank you to Audio Boom for hosting us and generally looking after us. And thank you to my friend and colleague Hannah, who helps me with all things podcast. I don't understand. Thank you to Barney Spiegel, who's helped us with sound and makes us sound clear as a bell for you all. My brother for writing the music, and my friend George Lee for drawing our caricature.
And finally, please don't let these stories, true crime tales, give you nightmares. And do be careful out there.